Major Turner, Reel 4. You were a pilot. Did you fly into Burma yourself? Were you in charge of one of the gliders as you went into the second Chinook campaign?
No, sir. I was prepared and was flying crew prior to the actual fly-in to Burma. My qualifications, such as they were that I was useful to the Chindit operations by virtue of my knowledge of the airplane and my knowledge of mules. The actual flying part for me was in the areas prior to the fly-in, and I ipso facto went, as all others did, in the shell of the aircraft, but flown by American crew, towing a glider in my case. I'm sorry, two gliders in my case, on the last day of the fly-in, namely March 9th of 1944.
What was your own flight like on the 9th of March?
Very happy and unremarkable. A wee bit noisy because, of course, we only had a partial load. Partial, that is, full up on the air on the ground floor space, but partial in that there was nothing overhead. It was rather like a big tank, and the noise resulting therefrom and the external noises. But nothing else remarkable. I can remember nothing very special about it, except the landing part, where we went down using full lights on, the aircraft that is, and the area below was floodlit by parked aircraft, and the sappers who had worked on it had some sort of floodlighting system, and it felt to one, having been in the darkness previously, total darkness previously, less that of the full moon, it felt like going down into Piccadilly Circus with so many lights on, yet we knew, truthfully, we were within a total jungle area of Burma. But, I repeat, on the wrong side of the Irrawaddy.
What was the name of the place where you landed?
Truthfully, I can't remember. I don't remember. It wasn't a place as such. It was a stretch of water. That is all. A huge sandbank. There was an army name given to it and the area thereby, but I don't remember the name as such.
Was there any damage or casualties on landing?
One or two, yes. Every glider, of course, was pitchforked into a local jungle, so damage in that regard, yes. We lost several mules. I know of no man having been lost or hurt, really hurt. And in the main, we came out of that one pretty damn good. The problems were a little later than that when we had to get across that stretch of water. Our main losses came then. And comparatively speaking, for the numbers involved, those losses were minimal. Nonetheless, every mule was one less, which meant we had one extra load to carry, since there were nothing taken that didn't have to work. Everything was a working unit, a mule driver, his mule, and the load they carried. So to lose the mule, the method of transport, threw a great problem onto, if you like, me personally in the final analysis, but more immediately the sergeant in charge of the local platoon concerned, how to dispose of, or how rather to carry the load, since he couldn't dispose of it or ditch it without the consent of the brigadier, nor could I. Only with the brigadier's full knowledge and understanding could I give the orders to ditch anything at all. Somehow or other, we carried everything.
Do you remember your first brush with the Japanese at close quarters?
Yes, sir. It was a personal one, too. It was one where I had an involvement through taking what I call the sacrament, but I think we call it the Holy Communion. Anyway, it was taking the blessing from the Padre. I've always been a great believer in prayer, not terribly religious chap in the sense of going to church always and every Sunday, but most Sundays. And that we had a traveling padre who went from column to column, giving, as I repeat, the sacrament to those who wish so to do. I was among those who stayed. I had with me some Gurkha soldiers, of course, who did not participate, and some British other ranks who did. We were 29 people in total, 28 chaps and me. And we took this, I personally, with a few others, about a dozen of us probably, took his blessing, which in this case was performed by his using a fallen tree trunk with a large white handkerchief on it, which we now allowed it to be that that was the altar. And there was no taking of wine, but he used his hand on by the touching of one's head when we were in a kneeling situation. So the padre administered this particular function of his to the advantage of us all. And it was during that particular time that we became, 28 chaps and I, became encircled with a bunch of Japanese. And we became, in effect, immediately prisoners. Prisoners of war, if you like, but not in a Japanese prisoner of war camp. We were just caught. This lasted for some while because the Japanese, as I repeat, were in great strength. And the Japanese were in great strength at this particular time, and they wanted us to be ensured that we would not escape. So they took from us our shoes, boots rather, and my sidearms. I had carried two revolvers because I had to dispatch the mules, and my cookery, and any other equipment of like nature they took from us. So we were now denuded of the means of walking. Ipso facto, we were also within an area of a basha locally that the officers of the Japanese used as their mess. And we were there for something approaching a month, between two full moons, 3.5 weeks or something like that. And we knew a brigade had gone north at this point. And one particular, we had worked out between us that the only way to get out of this was to escape by virtue of a night run, if we could make it, bearing in mind we had nothing on our feet. And also, on a given night when these officers had been drinking their sake, I think they called it, S-A-K-K-I, rather a lot, indulging greatly, and were not being too intelligently watching out of their window from the basha. Wasn't a window, it's a hole in the side of the wall anyway. But anyway, to cut a long story short, we decided on a given night to do just that. And the Gurkha soldier gets so excited and wants to exude a wonderful sort of a presence when he's fighting. And if he's charging, he likes to shout. So all this had to be done quietly, and I had to take away from him, and my British other ranks anyway, any question of them doing anything. And so I had to personally do the job myself, watched by them and aided by them if I went wrong. Namely, that The area in which we were was guarded by four Japanese soldiers who paraded the four sides of this rectangle and often came up from one corner to another and talked and then receded to their correct positions. And so we noted there were times when two Japanese soldiers would be talking and another time when there was no one there at all. And so I had to wait, we had to wait, until these two soldiers were together. And prior to all of this, we had been taught unarmed combat, whereby it is that by the depressing the Adam's apple in a man's neck, you can break the vertebrae and he will die by being croaked. And he will fall quite literally if you break it as in a violin string. And he will not make a noise in so falling. So the officer looking out would not have heard. He could have seen, but he would not have heard or be distracted from his drinking. And I dispatched two Japanese soldiers at one point, and some minutes after, before the other two could find out, I dispatched those two using my big hands and my two thumbs, pressing the front of the neck, and it worked each time.
How is it that you were able to deal with them without the other three knowing?
Because they were on the opposite sides of the quadrangle, the rectangle rather. And remembering is at night, no moon, the full moon had gone, and we were between moons on this one, and our only possibility of doing this at all was in darkness, because we were so afraid of these Japanese officers looking out from their window area, and didn't. But they had a light within their basha. We had no lights at all outside. So we had to do them two by two, and had to do them quickly two by two before the second two could find out where were their other two chums.
But did you do it by yourself?
Or? Yes, yes. Helped. I did it personally on my own with no one else, yes. But
why didn't you arrange for, couldn't you have trusted three of the others?
No, sir. No, sir. No, sir. It was so critical. You see, the main people with me were Gurkha soldiers. The half a dozen or so British other ranks who had taken communion, as I did, were such that I didn't know them well enough to be able to trust. Not so much trust or offer them the opportunity. And so I know, as one always knows when you're up against things like that, one does it for oneself to make sure it's done properly, so to speak. And I did it just like that. But where they were behind me, and in the event that I failed or it didn't go right, they were there to take my place. But the important thing is I didn't ask it of them to do it. And I happened, by the grace of God, to succeed. That is all.
So you felt more confident just doing it by yourself?
Granted, granted. One does. You know, in these things, you lead the way. I suppose it's part of one's early training. A bit of a leader, if you will. And then, as quickly as that also, we started to walk away from the area before we were going to be found. We must have been quickly found afterwards, but at this point we were not found. And we walked away to where we reckoned north was. And bearing in mind we were in bare feet, and English feet in the Burmese jungle do not work, so we wrapped our feet around by cutting off the bottoms of our trousers 6 inches at a time and binding our feet, and that lasted us well on and getting into the jungle proper. And once you're half a mile or so, or a few hundred yards even from that basha where these officers were, you could be, for all the safety in the world, 10 miles away. They could not, would not normally find you or catch you. So We managed, by the grace of God, then to keep walking and walking and walking and living on the country, and we eventually got back to Brigade. 28 chaps and I, 29 of us. We lost no one en route.
Did you have any adventures on the way back?
No, sir. No, sir. Save that of the odd snake and things like that, but no. We heard gunfire here and there, left and right, and we walked only when we felt it's reasonably safe to walk. And there's a lot of intuition, you know, initiative goes with this, rather. Namely, that there's guesswork as well. And we just made it by courtesy of the factors of cover by the jungle. In other words, the safety factor for us was equally our defense, as it were, their problem.
How had the Japanese treated you during those 3.5 weeks?
Not terribly more. They administered problems. I mean, as an example I have here, they lined us up one day. To keep our mules right, we used hydrochloric acid to keep their feet hard, because unless we could have very hot fires, you cannot shoe a horse or a mule in the field, even with a clever Richie. He couldn't do it either, because the heat factor for a pair of standard shoes was never good enough to alter that shoe to conform with the size of the foot he's dealing with, hoof he's dealing with. In consequence, we abandoned all that thinking, and we found it easier instead to ensure that we kept their feet hard using hydrochloric acid, which formed a hard skin over their hoof area, lower hoof area. And providing we didn't, the horn proper didn't split, the mule was mobile. And in being mobile, he was doing his job. He was being able to walk. But once he goes lame on you, he is of no good to you, and you have to discard him and the load he's carrying. So the whole factor of real help was these 5-gallon drums of hydrochloric acid, part of which, one, when we were always trained, by the way, when we went into camp, never to leave a drum part empty, part full, if you will. Never to leave any residue in the drum. Empty it right out, fini, and start a new one. But there must have been some mistake where if you didn't upend the drum properly, there was a residue of this stuff was left in one drum. And the Japanese MO found it. And he must have used it to brush across some skin somewhere, not knowing what it was himself, but it was an acid. So he lined us all up, all of us up, rather.
You mean he burnt himself with the acid?
Indeed. Then he lined us up and he took my arm and made these marks with a piece of bamboo, as in tattoo, and pierced it. And that the chap next to me, he did his ears with him, as a lady has her ears pierced. He used a bamboo stiletto thing and pierced this man's ears.
So
excruciating pain.
You're showing me the marks on the back of your left forearm.
That's right.
And that scars. Yeah.
And that's still there forever. It will never ever go, do you see? And it's not much, doesn't matter, it's covered up anyway, but it's an unsightly thing I'd rather not have, yes. And the third man in the row, they did his hairline for him. And he lost all the hair at the lower part of his head, at the nape of the neck, etc. So, because you see, at that time, we had air superiority, but they were very strong, numerically, on the ground. And inevitably, thereby, the Japanese doctor could only get up to his chaps, such as could come up by rail. And since we were blowing up bits of the railway wherever we could, there was no continuity even of that for him, coming up, say, from the Rangoon area up to where we were, because we were in the central and northern parts of central Burma. So
he did it out of pique because he accidentally burned himself.
Granted. And having so done, he didn't learn too much, but he caused problems for us chaps that we would rather not have had. And so it was. But we got away that particular night and we marched north and we caught up brigade. And we didn't lose a man en route either.
Did they ill-treat people in any other ways?
No, not that I remember, no. We had practically nothing in the way of food, of course. We had such as they gave us. Very squeamish sort of stuff. God knows what it was. It was some sort of congealed water, one felt. But what its real contents was, I don't know. But it was a food of sorts.
Did they have plenty of food for themselves?
I think so, yes. Because they seemed to combine their officers' mess wherever with a supply dump. And the lesser mortals within the Japanese ranks were those who became guards. So that the four guards that I referred to, that I had to dispatch, so to speak, were poor little human specimens of no great stature whatsoever, meek and weak, no doubt. They were doing their job, but unlike our people, when we pick our best soldiers to keep guard on a perimeter, they don't. They seemingly use the lesser specimens, and hence it was that much easier for me than it would have perhaps been otherwise.
Did they say to you what they intended to do with you?
No. There was no contact, truthfully. No verbal contact. And nor did we even know what might happen to us next day or next week or whenever. Nor did we know that we could survive the days we did. Because you don't. At the time, it's already a big mountain in your way of life. And something that happened, and you made it all work, but one ended there.
Why didn't they tie you up?
No need to, because they had taken away from us our arms and our boots. They knew that English feet in the jungle won't work. We could not work. We couldn't have walked 100 yards on our feet proper. Certainly could not run. We were pretty damn safe. It was scrub jungle, like walking on a hard brush, or brushes it would be, to English feet. Our feet were lacerated within only a few yards walk. But as I repeat, in order to help and save that, we cut off our trousers at the bottom end in 6-inch bands and use that to cover up the sole of our foot until that itself wore out, then another bit. But nothing altered the fact that by the time we got back, we had very badly lacerated feet and weren't good for anything. But at that point, in any case, evacuation was going to take place, although we didn't know it at that stage.
Were you interrogated by them?
No, sir. No.
Why do you think they didn't interrogate you? Because they didn't speak English?
I don't think, no. I think more honestly, they were lesser mortals. They weren't the top brass. They were elements of the Japanese soldiery out into jungle areas with probably grade 3 officers and lesser soldiering as well. Nothing about them indicated they were of any superior types. We all felt ourselves, even badly disabled as we were, we all felt ourselves to be very much superior to them, both physically and mentally. We think they were third-grade troops out in some forward position, probably lost by their top brass.
Coming back to the Chindits generally in the jungle, how was discipline maintained in the jungle?
Maintained by virtue of the prior training back in the Punjab and India proper. There was no question of indiscipline. There was no question of anybody doing anything wrong, save that stealing on the odd occasion by supply groups, by supply drops rather, chappies pocketing things to which they're not entitled. But other than that, there was no indiscipline. I never knew of anybody going wrong or adrift or anything. No question of even the censorship. I had one occasion where, it's an aside to this, but it's a story just the same, where one of our RAF officers took out a wireless set from his wireless pack and filled it up with tins of carnation milk and pineapple chunks that had been dropped. He had arranged to have dropped, and he found it in the dark. And he was carrying this illicit load on a mule that looked like a radio set to everybody else, including me. But when it went adrift on the mule's saddlery and fell off, I had to come to adjust it, and I knew very well there's something radically wrong, because the weight of a radio set was, this was about 10 times a radio set, weight rather of a radio set. And this officer had, one hell of a nice chap he was too, but he had, as it were, gone adrift by bringing in these illicit things, or having them brought in rather, from his chums back at base. And he got over it. He invited me to come to his party that night, so to speak, where he was now having pineapple chunks and with carnation cream. And to anyone who's roughed it as we had done it at that time, that was like going to Buckingham Palace for a meal. But except for the odd thing like that, there was no indiscipline at all.
So he tried to buy you off in a way?
In a way, yes.
What was your response?
Well, I fell for it, I must confess. I must be truthful on that one. He was my personal friend. And when you've had a personal friend, a most superb chap. He's dead now, by the way. He died the other day.